Sciences Po.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the next episode of Sciences Po Research Podcast. This is the podcast where I, Sergei Guriev, provost at Sciences Po, talk to Sciences Po researchers and visiting researchers about their own work on the most important issues of our time. This is season 3, when we talk about political, social, and economic implications of the digital transition, of the technological change that our societies are experiencing. And today, I'm very happy to have with us Yamil Velez, who is an assistant professor of political science at Columbia. Yamil is visiting one of our research centers, Sevipov, working with Vin Arsenault. Yamil is doing research on misinformation, on detection, prevention of false information on social media. His research mostly focuses on different political issues that are actually targeted by agents of misinformation, and that involves both immigration or medical issues, in particular COVID. And so Yamil's research is usually trying to design or study solutions to the problems of misinformation that may involve and result in political implications, in particular polarization. Welcome to the podcast, Yamil.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And it is great to be here. And I've really enjoyed my time so far here at Sciences Po. It's been great.
Thank you very much, Yamil. So your research focused on both political and medical dimensions of misinformation. You looked at the impact of the political polarization, polarized elections, but also debate about vaccination during COVID. Why those topics? Why do you choose these particular research questions?
So my interest in misinformation grew out of personal experience. I had studied the media in the past. I had projects looking at people's misperceptions about immigration, as well as the impact of Spanish language television on Latino voters. And during the pandemic, I started getting calls and texts from relatives claiming all sorts of very kind of odd and strange things about American politics. And I went to some of the credible news outlets that spoke to Latino audiences, and I noticed that there was very little information. A lot of the fact-checking arms had actually been disbanded after 2016. So if I wanted to, for instance, tell my aunt this is why this is false, there was no fact-check to provide. And so I became very curious about whether there were information gaps within the community and you know, the extent to which the misinformation problem was really prevalent. And at the time, we knew very little about how many Latinos, let's say, had bought into some of the misinformation that was floating around. So that kind of sparked my interest in this area.
And so what did you tell your aunt eventually? How did you solve this issue? Did you find the reliable sources?
So the only kind of tool I had at the time was to take some of the English language fact checks and effectively translate them. So I couldn't pass along a link to some of these credible sources that she trusted that provided news in Spanish. But the best I could do was to be you know, a knowledgeable nephew trying to kind of combat some of these false claims. So I would say that because my interest developed in this time, this very tumultuous time of the pandemic, where we were seeing a lot of misinformation about politics and medicine, this is part of what you know, ignited, I think, this interest in both of these domains.
I think it's a very interesting and important example of misinformation, which affects differentially marginalized groups and the majority of the population. But before going there, I would like to ask you about your relationship with your relatives, to what extent they would trust your expert judgment. A lot of the stuff which was going on during COVID was about trust in the elites, trust in experts. We know that populism is a phenomenon which often is based on losing the link, losing this trust relationship between non-experts and experts. You are not a medical expert. Why would your relatives trust your judgment on COVID, given that you're a political scientist and not a vaccine specialist?
Yeah, so my strategy whenever I was talking to them about these matters would always be to cite other experts and hope that at least their trust in me as a family member would be sufficient to counteract what other sources they were watching. Granted, the sources that they were consuming were not medical experts either. They were people on YouTube in many cases that were claiming certain things about either COVID or the vaccine, cures, and so on. And my hope was to at least inject a little more kind of credible information into my social network by, you know, mostly bringing in information from other experts and yeah, not trying to push it too hard to say that I don't work on like pharmaceutical drugs and safety and so on. So my hope was to be an intermediary.
Right. So when you started to work on misinformation as a scholar, what was the main research question and what was the methodology and what did you find?
So the main research question, and this was a joint project, started right before the vaccine rollout. And this was with Ethan Porter at George Washington and Thomas Wood at Ohio State. Our main research question was, when you have a new vaccine that's being rolled out, there's a lot of uncertainty, there's going to be a lot of misinformation. And the idea was, can factual corrections have an effect on people's beliefs about, let's say, the efficacy of the vaccine, about specific claims about the vaccine and the virus? And also, does it have any effect on behavior? And so we actually were trying to approach it more from this kind of empirical perspective, not from a normative lens, but more trying to understand the power of information. Can information actually change behavior? And I think we were a little shocked by what we found across several studies, which was that information, factual information, can affect beliefs. So people, you can change people's beliefs about the state of the world, but it's really hard to change people's attitudes, their evaluations of vaccine efficacy. It's hard to change behavioral intentions. And so across all of our studies, we found that factual accuracy improved when you provide people with fact checks, but there was virtually no effect on actual behavior. And so my, research agenda since then has been trying to figure out when information actually translates into changes in behavior.
Yes, this is actually a very, very important issue that people think that providing factual information can change behavior, but the intermediate link, which you mentioned, which is beliefs and attitudes, which sometimes are very, very hard to influence. And sometimes that creates a counter effect. We actually have a paper with Oscar Barrera, Ekaterina Juravskaya, and Emerick Henry, where we show people false news coming from a French populist politician on immigration, and then we provide fact check. And we find that people change their beliefs about facts, but not their political attitudes. They still want to vote for this particular populist politician. Actually, some of them want to vote more because we raise the salience of this particular policy question. And they remember that this particular politician actually is focusing on this immigration issue. In COVID, I guess the salience issue was not important because salience was always there. People would worry about COVID. So you didn't have this backlash effect, right?
Yeah, so we didn't have a backlash effect. But I suspect that some of the mechanisms that you're highlighting might have been relevant here as well. So if, let's suppose, someone believes that mRNA vaccines modify their DNA, and that's a claim that they believe. But that's not the core belief that undergirds why they are uncertain about vaccination. Let's suppose it's trust in elites or trust in pharmaceutical companies. If you dislodge that belief about mRNA vaccines, it's unclear whether factual information is going to have any effect on behavior, because that's not the actual belief that is contributing to the vaccine skepticism, right? And so you have these kind of more distal beliefs that matter less to people, and maybe these fact checks were effective in getting people toward factual accuracy on those beliefs, but you have core beliefs that maybe are still intact.
So when you talk about core beliefs, this is more like trust in the elites, the belief that elites actually develop those vaccines for you and not to make money on you, and they do care about you. These are the issues you're talking about, right?
Exactly. And fact checks that target very precise claims that are kind of laser focused, this is much of what you see fact checkers do. They might not do the best job of targeting these bigger beliefs that I think are harder to move.
And when we talk about methodology, what exactly did you do?
So we use an experimental methodology, which I think is the standard in this misinformation literature. And part of that is because of self-selection issues. In observational settings, it's really hard to disentangle causality when people are selecting into different kinds of information. And so we use this idea of kind of A-B testing, where it's you're randomizing people to either get a fact check or get some placebo message or a control message.
Right. And then you show the message and then you ask people if they are willing to change their behavior or your observed behavior or...
We tried it several ways. So we would ask about intention, and we also had behavioral measures such as, are you willing to, you know, click this link for more information about vaccine sites and registration? And on those outcomes, we also observed no effect. So we tried to include kind of these quasi-behavioral measures within surveys.
Excellent. Thank you. So you mentioned already the issue of disproportionate impact on marginalized parts of the society. How did that play out during the COVID? You gave the example of your family, but more generally in your research, how did you study this issue?
So one of the reasons why, and this I think applies to immigrant communities in the U.S. and potentially elsewhere, that misinformation can be an especially pernicious issue is that many immigrant communities, in part because the relationships cross borders, use technologies like WhatsApp, these private encrypted messaging platforms, where it's really difficult to flag false content. It's not like social media where people are on Facebook, on Twitter, that you can display a fact check, you can have accuracy nudges. These kinds of tools of slowing down the sharing of information are really difficult when people are mostly communicating via messaging apps. And so this has, you know, there's been some evidence that Latinos who use these technologies may be more susceptible to believing false claims, in part because they're basically receiving a lot of false information that goes unchecked. There's no fact check. There's no way of tagging or flagging the content. And so I think that is at least one of the technological challenges. In terms of media, many Latinos in the U.S. Live in so-called news deserts where there's less access to news and credible information. Often there won't be a Spanish language newspaper or television station in one's community. And so I think that also creates a kind of information vacuum that can be filled in by other sources, potentially, again, like sources like YouTube and so on.
Yeah, the issue of WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, but functions very differently. It's actually a very interesting issue in political science. We know of a Facebook president. This is a president of Romania, which won an election on Facebook in 2014, who is widely praised for his anti-corruption stance in a country which is suffering from corruption. And we know of WhatsApp president, who is Jair Bolsonaro, who won his campaign on WhatsApp. And there, indeed, the issue was exactly as you said. He disseminated a lot of false news, and now it's known, it's actually established that part of his campaign paid for dissemination of false news about his competitors, and that was impossible to check. That was impossible to fact check. And that links to the experience of Latin American immigrants in Latin American communities in the U.S. because their relatives back at home use a lot of WhatsApp. Interestingly, part of that is due to what's called zero ranking plans. People don't know about that in rich countries, but in developing countries, it's very common, or used to be very common, when Facebook would pay for your internet as long as you only use Facebook apps like WhatsApp. And then even if I want to give you a fact-checking link, you cannot click on it because the only internet you can use is not browsers, but only the apps that I want you to use. And that is just a feature of being not a rich society. And that has an impact, has a very important side effect on American politics as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is very, very interesting. Coming back to political issues, health is important, but I guess as a political scientist, you also look at the impact on elections, on political polarizations. What have you learned about the misinformation and polarization in elections in that respect?
So A lot of my work, I think I would say, is on the intervention side. So trying to address the misinformation and seeing if there are some downstream consequences. One of the, I think, biggest questions in political science is the political effect of misinformation. Is misinformation just something that is just padding people's worldviews? So people who already distrust in elections are now just growing more confident because they are basically assimilating all of these beliefs about election fraud and low levels of election integrity into their worldviews. And so you're not persuading people, you're just basically further bolstering or making people more confident. It's unclear whether this process is more likely than a process where people are actually changing their minds, that you're getting people who want to vote and are now staying home. And so this is actually something that I'm really curious about, and trying to see if there are ways of testing this, you know, in using longitudinal data get at whether people who are exposed to a larger share of misinformation over time do see these decreases in turnout and engagement. But right now, I think it is really a big open question.
And so do you find the impact of misinformation on turnout of, say, Latino voters? Or
so in one of the fact-checking studies, so everybody gets a fact-check in the study, but the design is one where some people get a misinformation headline or a video, and then we measure outcomes, and then they get the fact-check afterwards. In our study, we did find a small effect in terms of Biden evaluations. So there was a piece of misinformation tying Biden to socialist leaders where we did observe some reduction in support. It's something that I don't know if it still holds in our current environment, just because some of these claims have, become very salient in terms of GOP or Republican messaging. But that was one case where we did observe some evidence of this the persuasive effect, but it did not hold across outcomes. So we didn't find it with respect to election integrity or election trust and turnout intention. So it was kind of narrowly focused on how people felt about Biden.
But you said it's a small impact. Okay. So your research is rather showing that people get reinforcement of their prior beliefs, or sometimes they change a little bit, but that doesn't have significant impact on turnout or voting intentions.
So far, yeah.
So that's an optimistic result, which is somewhat in line with the recent meta studies, right? The study co-authored by 20 political scientists in the U.S. and Facebook parent company Meta. It's not a meta-analysis, it's a study funded and organized by Meta with independent researchers, which also found that in 2020, the impact of social media on the election was actually limited. Now, you worked on midterm elections. Now we are in the year of presidential elections. And this is the 2024 election, which is following the hype about generative AI, which especially grew since November 2022 when ChatGPT was introduced, and then the whole 2023 was rollout of various generations of generative AI. You're working on this, you're producing recommendations to policymakers, to platforms, I guess. What would you say? What should the world do about generative AI if we want this election year, which is not just election in the U.S., half of the world actually votes. What is the impact of AI, and what should we do about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I sat down with a team of researchers at the University of Chicago and Stanford Graduate School of Business, and we enumerated all the ways that generative AI could affect elections. We mostly landed on similar worries that have emerged for non-generative AI misinformation. You know, politicians being reported to have said things they haven't said or done things that they haven't done. The risks of generative AI are maybe similar to some of the risks that we've seen with misinformation more broadly. But there is a distinct challenge for generative AI, which is that the technology is trained in such a way that humans are not supposed to spot the difference between generative and non-generative content. And they're trained so that humans prefer certain pieces of content over others. So you use these tools like reinforcement learning with human feedback, where people are given different completions from these models and the model starts learning what humans prefer. And so I think this is challenging from the perspective of addressing the problem, because tools like inoculation or digital literacy may not be a good match here, because you can't really provide people with really good diagnostic information of what's generative or non-generative. Now, you know, we know that from some generative images that you can rely on the six-finger problem. But that's going away. There are certain tricks.
Can you say a few words of what the six-finger problem is?
So the six-finger problem is that generative image models like DALL-E, Stable Diffusion, in the past have had problems with modeling human hands. So you'll create a scene, you'll notice that a person will have four or six fingers, and that's usually a way to tip, that tips you off to the fact that this is generated by an AI.
In academia, there is also false references problem when generative AI would create references which don't exist. But
that's
as
right.
You rightly said, by now, both the hand problems, six-finger problems, and this false reference problem are being addressed by the next generation. Right?
Yeah, that's right. The newer models, hallucinations were a huge problem, I would say, a year ago. They're still present, but they are being minimized. So now you'll have models that will actually draw return sources. So you'll get your summary about, you know, which elections are happening this year, and then you'll have actual web sources that you can then cross-check and reference. So yeah, the technology is moving quickly, and again, we're getting to this place where it's going to be really difficult to distinguish between the different types of generative and non-generative content. So we might have to develop new tools, new strategies for addressing this issue.
But by the very nature of what you've just said about generative AI, by the nature of generative AI, it will be very hard to find new tools, right? By definition, whatever tools we create to teach people how to distinguish AI from non-AI, deepfakes from truth, deepfakes are created to deceive our tools. Deepfakes are created to convince us. Whatever courses we take in terms of digital literacy. So what would you suggest?
Yeah, the technology that I think is likely going to be the only path forward is this kind of these provenance standards, where anytime someone uploads content to the internet, a social media platform, they'll have to digitally sign it. And there will have to be some kind of history of how this piece of content was created. So there are standards like C2PA, that OpenAI, Microsoft, some other tech companies have been encouraging, where basically any content creator will have to have not only some signed content, but there will have to be some history where you can actually tell where this piece of content emerged. I think that might be the future for us, is to at least have a sense of how the content is created. Now, granted, you still run into issues of trust, right? Because then there are going to be, I'm sure, news organizations that will use generative AI to deceive. You might have all of the provenance information in the world. You might know that, sure, it was digitally signed by news organization X, but that might still be very persuasive. That might still have an effect on your beliefs. Ultimately, we're coming back to like a trust-based system.
We've seen recently the same revolution happening in academia, when more and more researchers are required to provide replication data, replication protocol throughout the disciplines, even the disciplines which didn't do it in the past. And moreover, journals are now having replication editors, data editors who actually run replication on every single econometric or statistical exercise to check if these sources actually work. But indeed, in politics, when the purpose is to deceive, often to convince, to persuade, but sometimes that means to deceive, indeed we will have bad players. And so the question is not just to provide sources, not to just digitally sign, but also have the infrastructure of players who do checking those sources, checking the provenance, whether it's actually true or not, right?
Yeah.
Who would play this role?
I imagine fact checkers will likely pivot, and we'll see them moving beyond just trying to track down, let's say, the original social media posts, some of the tasks that they're already working with to basically making it clear and easy to readers where the information is coming from, what the sources are, and possibly their credibility. And so maybe fact-checking organizations, news organizations will have to have these arms that are doing this like provenance verification.
Yeah, and the question arises, so we already asked questions about the business model of fact-checking, and given that how hard it's going to be and how much more massive and important it's going to be, do you have any ideas, any suggestions on how we fund this important effort?
Yeah, I mean, it's very controversial in the U.S. I know Europe has a different stance on regulating tech companies, but there is an element of, you know, if this is the medium through which some of this information is floating, then tech companies might have to bear some of this responsibility of, you know, integrating this technology into their platforms and also facilitating linkages between these organizations and users, much like they've done with flagging and tagging online, where obviously Facebook and various other platforms have directly collaborated with fact-checking organizations. So I imagine a similar move will be made with provenance.
Right. Yeah, in Europe, there is a Digital Services Act, which requires company to address those risks and disclose what they do about those risks, as well as make algorithm transparent to researchers. And we at Sciences Po will have a project on, we actually just started the project on working with disclosed algorithms. So I think indeed in Europe, you have this thing which is going to work hopefully well. In the US, much focus is made on self-regulation. And I guess your own research suggests that with all the efforts that Facebook is making, these efforts are probably not sufficient to stop the misinformation from flowing. Is that a right characterization of how self-regulation works and doesn't work?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's obviously also this a lot of value placed on freedom of speech and the idea of, you know, this very heavy-handed content moderation is seen as highly, I think, controversial. So, I think we're likely just going to continue, at least in the U.S., continue seeing the model of flagging content online, and then maybe it'll be updated for provenance.
So looking into the future, what is the research you're working on? What are the most exciting research projects you're doing right now?
So yeah, on the note of generative AI, one of the most dissatisfying parts of that research agenda of trying to address misinformation was this recurrent finding that, again, we were shifting beliefs in very, very discrete claims, but there was no larger kind of attitude change. And, you know, you could think to yourself, okay, well, the reason why the fact checks are not effective are either one, maybe people are not getting enough fact checks. So we might assume you read one fact check, it's not going to shatter your worldview. It's not going to probably change much. So we should expect very small effects. So that's one explanation. Another explanation, and these could be complementary, is that you're not targeting people's core beliefs. And so if you knew exactly why people were engaging a certain behavior and you were to provide information that was relevant to those core beliefs, then maybe you would see some attitude change and behavior change. And so there's a big debate in political science about whether receiving contradictory information persuades or it causes backlash or backfire. It makes people even stronger believers in their position. The issue is a lot of this work that has recently come out suggests there's a lot of moderation. So actually you provide people with a counter-attitudinal piece of information, a rebuttal, and they moderate. And the challenge with some of that work is that they often assume that people care a lot about issues like, let's say, gun rights, or they care a lot about misinformation. And if people have weak attitudes or weak beliefs in those domains, then corrective information probably will cause them to change their beliefs and update in the direction of the evidence. What we might be more interested in, however, is when people possess really strong beliefs in something, what happens when someone tries to convince them that let's suppose they believe that abortion is a right. If they get contradictory information, what happens in those cases. And so we've actually been using generative AI to see how people respond to persuasive information when they care a lot about an issue. So they write in a text box an issue position that they might hold about the environment, gun control, whatever it is, and then they receive a personalized rebuttal. And we see basically how attitudes change as a result of this. And initially, we found some evidence of moderation, but part of it was because these models are very courteous and civil. They're very kind. Turns out when you ramp up the kind of vitriol, which is often something that you see on social media, we got backfire. Replicated the more recent literature in that people moderated their positions and validated the older literature in that there was some backfire, but it had to be paired with vitriol. And so we see this as a really interesting case of using generative AI to answer an important theoretical question, because now you can create personalized surveys that adapt dynamically to what people are writing. That's an area that I'm really excited about is seeing what happens when you possess a very strong issue position and you receive different pieces of information. What are ways of, let's say, reducing the really high levels of polarization that we're seeing in the U.S.? I think these tools can be really effective in studying these processes.
So this is a very interesting methodological innovation. It's very important step forward. Just out of curiosity, how do you ramp up vitriol? How do you make those messages more insulting or more emotional? The models, as you rightly said, large language models usually are trained on polite text and remain polite. How do you make them less polite?
So this is, these tools are really good at following instructions. So anyone who has worked with ChatGPT, if you give it kind of really flimsy instructions, that often won't perform the task that well. But if you give really detailed, good instructions, it'll follow your lead. And so basically for these later experimental tests, we basically just instructed it, hey, we really want you to kind of ramp up the temperature. We want you to be clear that you're directly attacking this person's position. And it could be anything. It could be, whether someone believes that time zones should all be unified. And the model would happily provide a heated rebuttal saying, that this is absurd. No one would ever want this, And so it's really interesting seeing how powerful these technologies are. And I think they'll be really helpful research tools for us to understand psychology.
Thank you. It's, in a way, a very optimistic message, which suggests if we have a polite conversation, we have more chances to convince people to change their beliefs, to influence what they think and detect and overcome misinformation, circulation of false facts. And in that sense, it's nice that we are having a polite and not too emotional of a conversation, and that will remain so on our podcast. That's all for today. Please stay tuned for the next episode, where we will continue to discuss political, social, and economic implications of our digital transformation. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Yemil.
Thank you so much. Science Po.